When I was thinking about preaching this, I was thinking about preaching a completely different sermon than what I'm going to have to preach today. Because it occurred to me today that being without power for 2 or 3 days has changed us a little bit. How many of you are cranky?
No.
A little bit, anybody feeling disoriented?
Yes.
Anybody feeling a little bit trapped? The first day of this, yesterday, for us, Carrie was supposed to leave the house and work all weekend. She's actually supposed to be working all weekend. She's on call right now. We'll be heading out right after church is done. But we woke up to a car that didn't work, first of all. It wouldn't go over 45 miles an hour. And the other car, low on gas. So we got up, and Carrie had to search around for a gas station because all the gas stations were closed. She's got hospice patients in Columbus that need to be visited. So she spent an hour on the road looking for gas, first of all, to get to her job. And of course, trees down everywhere, as you all know, power out everywhere. The day started off with a bang for us, but not as much as a bang for other people who had real damage to their houses that they had to deal with in the midst of having all the other infrastructure that we depend on in life pretty much gone. Some people without water, which is a real concern. And it really made me take into consideration how much we rely on each other. And when I say each other, I mean the common wealth that we've created as a nation in order for us to live the way that we live. The gas that we figure out how to get to each other, right? The electricity that we figure out how to get to each other, the water that we figure out how to get or not get to each other. A lot of what determines how we live day by day is determined by things that we as a society have set up to serve the commonwealth. And the topic that I was going to preach about today was seeing beyond the American dream. And wow, in a way, it seems more poignant today than it did 3 days ago. Because I don't know about when you were growing up, but when I was growing up, there was a kind of an ideal for what the American dream was to me. I mean, I remember thinking in my own head what it would be like to live the perfect life, right? And what are some of those components for you that were part of the... Have some congruence there, and I hear what the American dream is. What is the American dream?
Own your own home. What else?
Have a new car.
Right.
Kids go to college.
Kids go to college. Have enough money for your kids to go to college. What else?
Have your kids do better than you do.
Have your kids do better economically than you do. Right. What else?
A job for a lifetime.
A job for a lifetime. Health benefits and pension. What else?
Live in a safe neighborhood.
Live in a safe neighborhood, right?
No scarcity.
No scarcity.
Good health.
Good health. Someday I'm harvest. Really, be able to afford a couple toys to enjoy.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All these things about that make up the American dream, they're so real to us, and they're real to us because we've grown up with our faces in front of television, really. I mean, we learned, even when I was a young kid, they were still showing Leave It to Beaver. And I loved watching Leave It to Beaver, you know, the perfect family living out in the safe, ethnically homogenous suburb. The father drives in the work is stable, makes enough money so that the wife, one of the members of the family, can stay home and spend hours of quality time every day with the healthy, well-adjusted children, 2.2 children, you know, to be respected amongst the neighbors because of the relative ease with which you can pull this all off. But you know, the more and more I think about this, the more I was trying to think this week, do I know anybody who lives like that?
Yeah.
I really don't. I can't think of a single person I know that pulls that off. And the question also occurred to me, why in the world should we be pulling it off? I mean, what are the costs of pulling that off? One of the things that I feel like happens to a lot of us is that we have a sense of epic failure if we can't pull it all together and make it the perfect life for us and our family. But who can do it if those are the definitions of what the perfect life is? I don't know anybody who can pull that off. And so a lot of people live with a lot of guilt about not being able to have healthy, well-lived, perfect children in a house with extra money to put in the retirement accounts every month. It's become unachievable for many, many people. And the reasons that this has become unachievable are really systemic, too. They have to do with the world economic order, as many of us know. I think I preached to the choir on this. They have to do with the U.S. regulatory environment that damages small businesses and subsidizes big businesses that send work overseas. They have to do also with ways that we have been constructed as people to imagine what's good and what's good for us. We have a lot of strange assumptions that are built into our culture that media really promulgates. And some of those assumptions are like this. It's better to live out of the city than in. We hear that a lot. Cities are dangerous places. I even hear on radio sometimes, there's all sorts of good programs to keep your kids off the streets. Here they are. And when I hear that, I just think, what a sad thing to have to say. The assumption that we need to keep our kids off the streets because the streets are not good for our kids. It's not good for our kids to be roaming around in the neighborhood. That's kind of a weird thing, really, when you think about it. The assumption that it's better to have independence, for example, to have your own car than to rely on public transportation. Right after the war and the car industry started cranking out those cars, the U.S. government made decisions about where they're going to put their money. They're going to put our money into roads. And we created a car culture, and we subsidized the car industry, and we promote the car industry. And the car industry did all sorts of things, as you know. In the 1950s and 60s, the car GM bought out a lot of streetcar companies. For what purpose? To close them down. And so we've created a culture of reliance on cars because at first cars were considered a convenience. One of the interesting things about the American psyche is that we've always been independent people and we value independence. And that idea of independence, for example, that the interests of the individual are more important than the interests of the state or the interests of the social group. That independence that's linked to individualism in that way creates this kind of idea that, wow, it'd be a lot better for me to have my own car than have to get on public transportation to go somewhere. So we develop a culture in which everybody wants their own car, and the more people have cars, the further out they're able to live, the further they're able to travel from work, and the more distance they're able to set between them and people who they feel like they don't want to be around. And what happened over the last 50 years and 60 years in this culture is that we have, because of this car culture and the de-emphasis on public transportation, we have hollowed out our cities. And people have been able to move further and further out. So that now we have little third world countries, most of our mid-sized cities in the United States. These are places where people don't want to live because they feel like it's unsafe. They don't want their kids on the street. The assumption that it's better to live in a homogenous neighborhood than in a diverse neighborhood. Even progressives fall prey to that. The idea that it's better to have privacy than to have community. The idea that individualism is the most important thing to preserve. Our rights as individuals to do what we want to do, we're not harming anybody else. Even if it's not in the long term, good for the social system. It's a driving force of American culture. And in a way, it's a form of idolatry. Think about how those assumptions have changed us over the years. First of all, without public transportation and with the hollowing out of our inner cities, we've created situations in which people are really segregated by economy and often by race, so that there's no mixing of people who have different kind of ways of living family life, different ideals about what the good life might be. And so the interaction is not there that we used to have maybe 100 years ago in our cities. We have fewer small businesses able to keep those cities alive because we've decided to send our businesses overseas, to allow businesses to send our work overseas. With the car, which was once considered a convenience, we now created a situation in which the car is a necessity. And just like we found out on Saturday morning, if you don't have a car or you don't have the gas to fill that car up, you're stuck. And so what was once created to help us be more free actually has become to this country. It has created a situation in which people are often landlocked. Think about the young who have no access to a lot of our culture because they can't drive yet. And because they can't drive, they're stuck at their house. I remember when we moved back from Japan, and my son was in seventh grade. And here we are in southern Yokohama, way down at the end of the Tokyo Bay. And my son calls me from school one day and he says, some of my friends and I want to go up to Kawasaki to see a movie. Kawasaki's way up in Tokyo. And I said, well, how are you going to get here? And he said, I don't know. We'll go ask the people at the station. And I said, well, okay. And up they went on public transportation up to Kawasaki, which is considered a bad area of the Tokyo metro, to a movie. They came back fine, all by themselves. And it occurred to me when we moved back here, one of the things that my son struggled with is the fact that here we are back in Granville, this ideal community, and he's stuck. He can't move anywhere. He can't even get to Newark to the movie theater without driving a car. There's nowhere to walk. One of our student Tara, you know, one of his constant little bugs was, well, what is there to do in Granville? I'm going to go to it. How many times can I do this? The lack of mobility that we force upon the young who don't have access to transportation makes this culture really different than a lot of other cultures around the earth. A lot of developed cultures don't have the same social situation we do because of that. Think about the way also it affects the elderly. As people get older and become less and less able to drive themselves, they depend on other people to take them to their doctor's appointments and get their groceries and take them from place to place to make their life rich. And they all of a sudden become landlocked. And because of this, people feel like, well, I need to make my parents transition into a retirement home because they're out there all by themselves and can't get anywhere. And so since the 1950s, in which we had almost no retirement homes in the United States, now we've developed a culture in which we segregate people away from community life, and they can't get anywhere because they can't drive. It's different. And again, in a lot of cultures around the world, this isn't the way they organize themselves. Taro's going back to a household in which he lives with his sister, who's going to college, graduated from college, his mother, his father, his grandmother, and his grandfather. They all live under one roof, as do most Japanese families, until the parents die. There are different ways we can organize ourselves. One of the things also that's an effect of this is that since we're so dependent on these cars to get us from place to place, because we have no public transportation, we decided it's better to live away from people who are different than us than to live together with people. Is that we're dependent on oil because we need oil for these things to move, and so we end up fighting wars of conquest for oil. And let me tell you, what's really worrisome about this to me is that the people who fight those wars are not the people with the stocks in the oil companies. When I came back for home assignment in 2005, I remember I went on mostly eastern U.S. assignments, and so I had a lot of assignments on the East Coast where I would go to high steeple. Mainline, mostly professional class churches, mainline Baptist churches. And in those churches, in their bulletins, very seldom did I ever see anything in the bulletin about the war. Very seldom. Then I would visit churches in western Pennsylvania, eastern Ohio, West Virginia, and in almost every church bulletin I went to, there would be a section on the back that says, pray for our boys and girls in the military. And there would be a list of names of people from those communities that were fighting the wars, all from impoverished communities. Is it senators' sons who are fighting for oil? No. It's another way that this culture has created an exploitative environment in which people feel like the only option for them, the good option for them that's going to get them a pension and health care, is to join the military. Another thing that this causes is terrible costs to our environment. Right now, we're going to have after church a session on fracking. Think about this. Again, the system here in America says live on natural resources, oil, gas. If you go to Germany, which has far more solar power, uses far more solar power than America does, than Ohio does, you'll actually find out that the hours of sunlight in Germany are fewer than the hours of sunlight in Ohio. There's no reason why we could not use solar power in Ohio, put up wind turbines in Ohio, and yet what do? We're going to try to extract more natural resources because if you turn on the button, it's quicker, it's cheaper for the companies involved, and without any thinking about the long-term effects, or very little thinking about the long-term effects, you know, rush into something that could produce energy, sure, but we could produce it in other ways. Why is there no conversation about that? This is another effect of this way of living that we've become accustomed to. Another thing that I think is difficult in this American dream mentality in which people kind of move out in order to find a perfect life is you end up with what has been called soulless suburbs. You know, do any of you have the ill fortune to live in soulless suburbs? You know what I'm talking about. I remember when Kay and I moved back from Japan, we were blessed really with a rental house that was very cheap. But it was in one of these suburbs that had been built way out on the outskirts of Delaware, Ohio. And literally, it was 50 streets full of houses that were almost exactly like one another. And there was no way that you would be able to walk to any kind of convenience store, grocery store, any kind of entertainment, no cafes, nothing. Once you were in there, if you didn't have a car, you were stuck. And interestingly enough, in our neighborhood, here on Beachwood, we don't have sidewalks. Makes it a little hard to walk around. But there were sidewalks everywhere. You just sneak in and use them. They were sweeping it off, or they were shoveling it off. And they were like, why are you really shoveling off the sidewalk? Nobody walks on them. And then you walk around and see the same five house sides for miles and miles and miles. It's soulless. And so you find people, and kids, especially teenagers, who are lonely out there. The image here in the Bible of a renewed world is an image of community where people are together, they live together, they play together, they eat together. The kids are out there in the streets playing with one another. It's a very different image of what a lot of people come up with when you think of the American dream. And so one of the things I have to ask myself is, how can we be restorers of streets to live in? How can we be restorers of streets to live in? What would it take for America to really step back and think, what do we really want our lives to be? How do we want our communities to be? Do we want people to know each other? Or do we not care if people don't know each other? One of the horrible things that I found out during this crisis right here is that a lot of people out in, even in this area, which is far better than most in terms of community, let me tell you that. Even in this area, there are people who don't know the neighbors right next to them. And so in times of crisis, they're not going to walk next door and say, gee, do you have a refrigerator I can put things in? Or can I borrow some water from you? You don't have well water and you don't have any water? They're reluctant to do that because they don't know their neighbors. And it's at times like this when we realize how important these kind of connections are to people. Connections that a church family provides, where we come together and we care for one another, we share our resources, we think about how we can give and provide the community at large. But a lot of people don't have that. A lot of people are growing up, teenagers growing up, people who are middle-aged, stuck in houses where really they're an oasis in what for them is a community desert. They don't have connection. They go to their work, they come back, they watch the television. Is that the way we want to live our life? Is that the American dream, no matter how much money you have in the bank? What kind of life is that? How can we be restorers in the streets? And how can we continue to press people who are in this country to think beyond this vision of the American dream? It's interesting that when I was thinking about this, I thought, what would life actually be like if instead of pursuing the American dream, you tried to set out to pursue something that wasn't essentially narcissistic or consumptive, something that is more like God's dream for the community? What would our cities look like? What would our villages look like? Would we separate people by class or race or income level? Would we put retail way out in the boondocks with no public transportation to it? Would we segregate our kids so that they stay in flight all the time watching television rather than giving them opportunity organically to be with others and to create genuine meaning in our lives? As we think about the future of this nation, we need to think about those questions, because these are questions that are essential when we think about God's call to be restorers of cities to live in. Let's pray. Oh God, we thank you for the community we have here, and we thank you for the relationships that we have with one another. It's particularly at times like these when we realize how important they are. Help us to reach out and care, and help us continually press for that world that you envision of connection and relationship. We ask this in Jesus' name.